In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Hi, welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman, and this is actually a special episode I'm doing with my friend Greg Fries, who is the editor-in-chief over at EMS1.com. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm really good, Jim. Thanks for having me, and it's been a long time since you and I have done a podcast together, so I'm looking forward to this opportunity to talk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I congratulate you on your new position over there at EMS One. I excited for you when I heard that. I was like, wow, I know somebody really got a job that, you know I would love to have, and I'm sure a lot of people out there would love to have that type of an opportunity. So congrats on that.
Thanks, Jim. I just want to say, if you have listeners that aren't familiar with EMS1.com, it's the leading online news and information site for EMTs and paramedics, not just in the United States, but around the world. And I would encourage any listener to visit EMS1.com, become a subscriber to receive our newsletter. And we also have an app in the Android store and also the App Store if you want to receive the latest updates and news and columnist articles from EMS1.com on your smartphone.
Yeah, that's great. And what I'll do, I'll put those links in the show notes for great. People so they can get access to that. I actually have the app on my phone, and of course I'm a subscriber to the mailing list there at EMS1 too, and love getting the news updates from them on a daily basis, which is nice. Keeps me sort of in tune with what's going on in EMS, you know?
Yeah. I think having a sense that EMS exists larger than just than your ambulance and how it happens maybe across the country or even around the world helps broaden our perspective and knowledge as EMTs or paramedics.
Yeah, you know, you make a good point with that, and I think that kind of a good segue into a couple of things, I guess, that I wanted to talk about today. When you talk about the bigger picture of EMS, and I think a lot of people do tend to kind of get stuck in their local area, what's going on with their protocols, their guidelines, and what they're allowed to do. And then when you look at sites like EMS1.com, you kind of get that sense that, wait a minute, you know, this EMS thing's a lot bigger than me, and there's stuff out there that's going on that is really changing the way we treat our patients, the way that we interact in our communities, and what we can do for patients, what we're willing to do, things that are changing that are better for the patients. And one of those things I know is giving Narcan out in the field, and how where I think that used to be really just a a paramedic skill.
Right.
Now it's everything from police officers, EMTs, and other first responders giving it. And I've even heard of them giving it to like these I don't want to say flop houses, but these places where
I think you just said,
you know,
it. No, but
I know
places where people end up, whether it's friends and family of people that might have an opiate or narcotic addiction. And I agree with you. It's I sort of call it 2014, the year of Narcan for everyone. I think it's fascinating. When you look at what at one point was an ALS-only intervention, giving Narcan in a very short period of time has become widely available at all provider levels, including the bystander level. And when you compare it to something like defibrillation, which was once only possible in an operating suite and, you know, when somebody's chest was cut open for a surgeon to be able to defibrillate them. And then, you know, huge machines that were moved around on a bus-sized vehicle in places like Columbus and Belfast. And then, you know, over this 40 years or more, time it took for defibrillation to go from the operating room to total ubiquity in airplanes, airports, all sorts of city and public buildings, and really an expectation that, you know, there would be an AED almost everywhere we go. How long that took compared to, you know, Narcan, and just the great speed with which that became available in a way that's so widespread.
Yeah, I mean, you think about, like you said, with the AEDs, how it went from even the size of them and how they've developed and improved upon them to make them so much easier to operate, where now it's almost like you see them hanging on walls at places like airports, almost like a payphone to just be able to grab it if you should ever need it, you know, because of people that are trained in that. And when we talk about things like Narcan, I think even back when I was, you know, first became a paramedic, and it was, you know, give it to them IV or IM only, and it was 2 milligrams at a time. And now, even at the paramedic level, where they started to get away from giving a full 2 milligrams to titrating it to effect,
right,
to giving it at, you know, 0.4 milligrams at a time to 1 milligram at a time, depending upon where you worked and what your guidelines were, to where now even I think when they first started even giving the Narcan to first responders and all, it was sort of IM administration, but now they're doing it where they're giving it intranasally, you know, which is even easier. You know, you're eliminating the needle,
right,
the potential for, you know, an IV stick for someone that's not trained in that type of safety,
mm-hmm,
and not aware of the safety risk for that. And now they have the intranasal way of giving it, which,
right,
is even safer, you know. So and I think that that's the type of thing where it saves lives and it prevents those patients that overdose, you know, on opiates, to you're having to get to the point where you're using that AED, you know.
Yeah, I think in one of the things that I think that's intriguing about it, and I suspect you and Josh have maybe talked about this in the past, is that we already have a solution, right, for somebody that's in respiratory depression because of opiates overdose, and that's the bag valve mask. And EMTs and medical first responders have that solution as well. But somehow that as a viable solution has been bypassed, either because maybe it's improper technique, so it's ineffective, or maybe there's some sort of attraction to the whiz bang of being able to give intranasal medication. But it's sort of been surprising for me that not only for the bystanders, but the, you know, the medical first responders, EMTs, and even paramedics, where we've overlooked this notion that, well, you could ventilate this patient instead and then wait for that ALS provider to arrive,
right,
with the Narcan. Somehow that step in the process is like, well, you know, let's just go straight to Narcan.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, you know, Tim Noonan has actually, you know, he has like a little graphic on his site at roadmatic.com where he puts that thing, that sort of image up about, you know, the overdose doesn't need Narcan, it needs bag valve ventilation.
Right. Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think that, you know, we kind of went right past that. And I wonder sometimes, I think probably a big part of it, there is an issue with the technique on using a BVM properly on somebody.
Right.
I mean, everybody said that's the one thing that gets sort of drilled into us even now when I've been going through training. Whenever I, you know, use the bag valve mask, it's the same type of thing. It's what's your technique? And that's, and they try to, you know, evaluate you on that technique. And I think that, and when you're not, you know, you're not using that bag valve mask every day, you know, at work, even as a field provider. So imagine trying to get somebody who doesn't use it every day,
right,
or use it even more infrequently than you do, to come along and trying to, you know, get the whole CE thing going,
right,
on and, you know, positioning the head the right way and all that. And then, you know, the issue of putting too much air into them, and then they start vomiting because, you know, you get too much, you get an air into the stomach, and now you have a whole other set of problems on your hands. Yeah. And I think with the Narcan, you know, especially giving it IN, it's, you know, a safe way to reverse that respiratory depression.
Yep.
And I think in the end, if it turns out that that's not why the patient is having a breathing issue, it's not going to do any harm. You know,
just the delay, not, I suppose, in figuring out what the cause of the respiratory depression is. You know, Jim, I think so. Narcan. So I, you know, I've been using this phrase 2014 Narcan for everyone. And then another phrase I've been using is backboards for no one. And, you know, as I look out my window here in Wisconsin, grounds covered with snow, I think about the analogy of, you know, the sort of campaign or the effort to say, hey, wait a minute, why are we using this backboard? We don't know if it works. It might cause harm. There's just no evidence. This snowball, if you will, has been pushed uphill for a long time by a lot of people questioning backboards, including you and Josh and the Rogue Medic and on this podcast. And now all of a sudden it seems like we've crested the hill and now the snowball is racing down the other side. And, you know, it's accumulating all sorts of organizations and people. They're saying, yeah, why are we backboarding anybody? And, you know, so for a long time, it was like, well, you know, we'll just keep doing this. And now all of a sudden there's, you know, major EMS services around the country are rewriting their protocols and saying, you know what, we don't need to backboard these patients that are up and walking around when we arrive on scene and they've got no, you know, spinal column pain and no complaints. And, you know, why would you put them on a backboard just because of the mechanism? And that's a sort of a pretty remarkable change that all of a sudden seems to be fairly widespread, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of goes back to what I mentioned earlier about people being kind of stuck in their local area where, let's say, their protocol is not giving up that backboard, not giving up that spinal mobilization. Because they're, you know, I think personally, I think the one of the main reasons why it went on for so long is because of the liability that people had perceived by not boarding and collaring everybody that had any kind of fall or any kind of mechanism that might injure their spine. Whereas now, since I think because you know, evidence that's been put out there and research that's been done and the constant, like you said, sort of that snowball effect of more and more higher up, you know, people coming out there and doctors and whatnot coming out and saying this is not helping our patient. Right. This is, if anything, it could be hurting them. You know, now they're able to sort of embrace a fact that, you know, it's not good to do that for everybody, that it's not the best thing for everybody. Yeah. You know, I mean, listen, I've been at the agency that I'm at now for about a year, and they've changed the protocol, you know, already twice because of it.
Great.
And they try to be very forward thinking with that. When I first got here, it was just sort of the same spinal clearance sort of protocol you had before where, you know, no pain, no distracting injuries, you know, no alcohol or drugs or anything like that on board. It might, you know, might mask spinal head or neck pain or whatnot. And now they've expanded it to the types of injuries to the point where if they're ambulatory on the scene and, you know, you want to go ahead and do that, you don't have to do the board. You can just put the collar on and have them sit on the stretcher, you know, either lie supine on the stretcher or sit upright and, you know, encourage them not to move their head.
Right.
You know, so, I think that's kind of going on, like you said, across the country now, where more and more agencies are rewriting their protocols for that. And I think, you know, until there's more research done that shows that doing that's harming patients, which I doubt that's going to happen. If anything, I think that as research comes out more and more for it, it's going to start showing that making this change towards less and less backboards is a good thing for the patients and a good thing. And I think, what was it? I can't think of the number now, but there was a financial aspect to it, you know, that whenever we do this to patients, that there's a higher financial cost to the patient, to the hospital, the time the patient's at the hospital, whenever you put them on a backboard.
Yeah, all that, you know, the cost of all that imaging, not to mention the time it takes to get somebody from, you know, the emergency department to wherever the CT scanner and back and all those different moves. And so the third thing, we can't let, you know, as we look back on the year, of course, Ebola comes to mind for me.
Oh, boy.
And just the huge impact I think that that had on EMS, mostly because we ended up with a few patients in the United States that had Ebola disease and then ended up being transported by ambulance, so whether it be the fellow in Dallas or the couple places where people were flown into the country and then moved by an ambulance to some sort of biocontainment unit. And I think what's, you know, there's a couple of things that I think are really interesting. One is just the sort of diffusion of information about, you know, not only the popular media, but then various EMS-related organizations trying to put out training and information. And even the CDC had some very specific guidelines for EMS, which they've even just recently updated here in early December. And then I think it's caused us as EMS to circle back to infectious disease transmission and the effectiveness of our precautions, not just for Ebola patients, but the sort of wide variety of patients that we might see that are sick with something that they could give to us or others. And, you know, I guess I'm hopeful that maybe the training, whether it be the hands-on donning and doffing or the reading and lectures about Ebola, have maybe there's some sort of all hazards crossover or all infectious disease crossover that organizations and individuals are taking away from this that might lower their risk of spreading other types of bloodborne or airborne infections in the future, not just Ebola.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. And the one thing that I kept thinking about when this was going on, too, is the way that when we train in EMS, we sort of just throw out that whole scene safety BSI sort of comment and not, you know, really understanding that BSI part of it and how important it is and, you know, how it really does sort of affect and can affect, you know, more than just what we're doing and can affect the what goes on with the patient down the road if they do end up having something. And the other thing I thought was, which I thought was great about it, which I guess is, you know, not to be happy about Ebola, but was how the response of agencies was pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the training that came out on, like you said, the donning and doffing of these you know, PPE equipment and how to handle these types of patients and how they were going to handle it if you did get one and what the steps were going to be and how the hospital was going to handle it. And it was a lot of information that was put out there, and it wasn't the type of thing where you just got a memo that said, hey, guys, you know, Ebola is out there, so be careful. Make sure you put your mask on if you think somebody's got it. You know, and that seemed to happen when I was dealing with, you know, the West Nile thing and all that. That was the most sort of training we got with that, you know, with a memo. Whereas this, it was actually, you know, a full sort of, you know, hour and a half class of, you know, the whole aspect of Ebola, how it's transmitted, who's at risk, where it comes from, and then our end of it as far as how to put the gear on, how to take it off, the policy in place on you know, how management was going to deal with it, what resources were going to be available. So it was such, I think, a quick response for most EMS agencies, I think, on dealing with it,
right?
You know. And while there weren't that many cases of it, you know, it was good that I think, like you said, that sort of kind of opened, I think, the industry's eyes, the profession's eyes, into, you know, dealing with PPE and hopefully making people more aware of the benefits of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when dealing with a lot of other things that maybe we come in contact on a more regular basis,
right.
You know? So, I mean, that was my takeaway from it. You know, it's funny, we did a podcast and Josh and Dave Brenner that does a podcast with us and talked about Ebola. And I said, how many Ebola cases have you had? You know,
yeah.
And Josh was like, none. And Dave was like, oh, I've had -5 cases.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, yeah, the chance of anybody actually coming in contact with it was low, but still.
Yeah.
You know, the training had to be out there because just in case it did turn out to be something that everybody was worried about.
I have one final thought. And just the innovation that's possible with training. One of the things that caught my attention was, you know, Wake County EMS was able to capture simply a video of their donning and doffing procedure and put it on YouTube and then share that widely, the link and information to that on various social networks. And then the University of Nebraska Medical Center biocontainment unit did some similar targeted at EMS training that was easily available, and I think part of the appeal was that they were able to rapidly make those, that as smartphones and the ability for any of us to record and create training has become ubiquitous, you know, services can not only create that for their personnel, but then offer it up to EMS agencies anywhere. So, you know, that's so my three things. There you go, looking back on 2014, Narcan for everyone, backboards for no one, and Ebola. So, Jim, I've appreciated the opportunity to talk to you about some of the, I guess, news and events of 2014.
I appreciate it, Greg. Thanks for taking the time with me. Anybody want to find out more about you, Greg? Do you still have your column going at EMS1, or are you going to be giving that up as editor?
Well, so of course I'm going to continue to write columns and articles, news analysis for EMS1.com. So that's probably the best place to find me. And of course, I welcome, you know, EMS professionals to connect with me on Twitter at @GFreeze. Or look for me on LinkedIn, and they can connect with me there as well. So, but EMS1, that's the place.
All right. All right, everybody. I will put links to Greg's contact and social media profiles in the show notes. And, of course, anybody have any comments or questions about the show, what we've talked about, we'd love to hear them. Be sure to post them below in the comments. You can actually send an email direct to me if you're not comfortable doing that out in public. You can send it to me privately if you'd like. And that email is contact@emsofficehours.com. Until next time, as always, this is Jim Hoffman for EMS Office Hours. Stay